dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we have the privilege of plumbing weekly is David Goldman, better known perhaps by some as Spengler for the superb columns that he writes under that byline in the Asia Times. He is also the author of How Civilizations Die and a frequent contributor not only to this program, but to other outlets where his clarity about the various challenges that we're facing, economic, strategic, even military, is required reading, needless to say. David, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, it's an honor to be back. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm wondering if you had a chance, I know you've been traveling to Europe, and we'll come to that in a moment, to catch up with an epistle, an open letter that, 100 or so individuals, most of whom have been associated with what has been called the sort of engagement approach to China. I kind of think of it as more the appeasement approach, but I'm going to pick the brains of several of our guests about this, and I wanted to start with yours. Susan Thornton, a prominent fixture in the previous administration and early in this one as an acting assistant secretary of state, was one of the lead dogs on this thing. What did you make of it?
Well, I think this is the China Incorporated public relations payroll in the United States. Their argument is that China is not an enemy. Well, of course, we're not in a shooting war with China. God forbid that we should be in a shooting war with China. I don't think kinetics will be necessary. But China is a strategic rival. And the difference between China and the evil Soviet empire is they wanted to make us slaves, and the Chinese want to make us sharecroppers. I don't like either alternative.
Right. It's not terribly appealing. And yet, these are folks who, in some cases, have held senior positions in the United States government. Others have been prominent fixtures in the academic community, and they are denouncing Donald Trump's policy as turning the Chinese into our enemies. Does that square with the facts as you've seen them?
The Chinese are a strategic rival, whether we like it or not. Vast amounts of money are made doing business with China, and all of these ex-administration officials either are making money or hope to. I think that the president has not adopted an optimal approach to dealing with strategic rivalry with China, and maybe some tensions have been created which could have been avoided, but we're going to go head-to-head with them, whatever we do. The question is to do it right and effectively. So I find Thornton and her colleagues to use a term deplorable.
Ah, that's catchy. Let me turn to the question of whether they're right in suggesting that we are going to find ourselves bereft of allies in going head-to-head with the Chinese. You have, as I mentioned, just returned from Europe, David Goldman, and you've been canvassing the sentiments of some of those allies, specifically with respect to the issue we'll be talking about more in coming segments, about Huawei, this Chinese company that has been making great strides in penetrating and, some would say, subverting the intelligence sharing and other relationships between us and friends in notably Europe. Tell us about your findings.
I and my colleagues at Asia Times have canvassed a number of European governments and talked to people at ministerial level. And sadly, our efforts to try to persuade the Europeans and others not to use Huawei's fifth-generation mobile broadband technology have fallen flat for a couple of reasons. One is Huawei offers better technology than the competition. The United States doesn't have any company producing a competitive product, which in my view is disgraceful. Secondly, Huawei is state-subsidized, so what they offer is very cheap. And third, Huawei is going to the world and saying there are new techniques, quantum cryptography, unbreakable ways of maintaining data security. China has pioneered them, which is true. And we will give you this ability to insulate your data, not just from us, but from the United States and everybody else. Very attractive proposition. And I haven't found a single government from the Sea of Japan to the English Channel who's turned it down.
And I don't know much about this. I'm sure most of our audience is new to this term, quantum cryptography. It's obviously based on quantum computing, but how can a government, say, of Great Britain, which shares, at least has to this point, the most sensitive intelligence in this country's arsenal, actually be sure that the Chinese aren't using quantum computing to break whatever cryptography they're making available to the Europeans, the Brits in this case in particular?
Quantum communications is like a letter that disintegrates the moment that human eyes set on it. It uses what's called the entanglement of atoms to create the signal itself. So the moment you try to eavesdrop on the signal, you change it and it's destroyed. So it's theoretically impossible to crack. I believe what's happening is that the whole world, there's a gold rush to get to quantum cryptography, not just the Chinese, but everybody else is rolling out systems for this associated with fifth generation broadband. I think the world believes that America's massive advantage in signals intelligence, that is electronics eavesdropping, is going to be wiped out by the new technologies. So the losses of intelligence sharing with the United States are far less painful than you might think they are. They've already decided that balance has gone to the defense in data protection, and they're not going to get as much from the U.S. As we might think.
Well, it will be interesting to see. I'm pretty sure they will get less than they have to this point. Whether it's of less value will, of course, be the open question.
Okay. Frank, when it comes down to it, we need a competitive product. We need to be a dominant player in all the key game-changing technologies like fifth-generation internet. It doesn't work for us to say, don't use the Chinese stuff when we don't have anything to sell in the market ourselves. And I think that's been a misstep by the administration. Hasn't worked.
We've talked about this on most of your appearances on this program, and I couldn't agree with you more. It's something that is vexing in the extreme. I'm not sure that the fault lies entirely with the administration, David, nor I think are you. You've talked about the immense amounts of money that companies like Cisco have been sitting on rather than investing in research and development that might well be providing us at this moment with the kinds of technologies you're calling for, no?
Absolutely. Somebody at Huawei actually told me, what we don't understand is why didn't the U.S. get Cisco to buy Ericsson, the Swedish telecom producer, and create a national champion to compete with us? That's what we're afraid of.
Yeah, well, and that's what we need for sure. Thank you, my friend, for your time today. As always, it's great to visit with you, and we'll look forward to doing so again next week. David Goldman, God bless. Next up, we will speak with Gordon Chang, taking stock on the letter from the appeasers, among other things, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent experts on Asia and most especially Communist China, a country in which he has been very actively engaged for quite some time. He lived in Hong Kong, but he's also written extensively on it, notably in three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea, as well as columns at The Daily Beast, The National Interest, Fox News, and elsewhere. He is always extremely gracious with his time. We're always appreciative of it. Gordon, welcome back. Good to have you.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Frank, and thank you for all that you have been doing.
Well, much of it with your help, I'm pleased to say. And Gordon, let me ask you about one of the things that I think probably troubles both of us, and that is a letter that was issued, an open letter to the president that was published in the Washington Post just before the 4th of July holiday. It was authored by 100 or so individuals, most of them with pedigrees in the China portfolio, but I think it would be fair to call them generically sort of the engagement crowd, the kinds of people who've brought us to our present pass. Susan Thornton, former acting assistant secretary of state, was among the signers and key drafters, apparently. She has written another piece at Bloomberg about their view that the president's got this all wrong and we need to get back to engagement. What did you make of this open letter? And is its advice either credible or certainly something we should be encouraging our president to embrace?
Her advice is not only wrongheaded, but it's also dangerous because it suggests that we continue on a path that has led us to perhaps catastrophic result. And so this is a letter of people who have failed and want us to continue on a path of failure. The letter in the Washington Post is titled something like, "We Should Not Make China an Enemy." And that ignores the fact that for four decades, we've been engaging China, trying to bring it into the international system. And China is the one that has made us an enemy. And if we needed proof, it came on May 13th when People's Daily circulated a piece by a sister publication, Global Times. And that piece, which obviously has official approval, is that it declared people's war, quote unquote, on the United States, branding the United States formally an enemy. So clearly, Susan Thornton and others have this wrong and not defending ourselves against the Chinese who believe that we are the enemy would be exceedingly dangerous for us.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, Gordon. You understand the psychology of people like Xi Jinping and their ideological drive to become the world's dominant power, namely communist China. How would a further embrace of engagement, for want of a better term, appeasement is another word for it, I think, be perceived by the Chinese, and how would they likely respond to that perception?
Frank, we know the answer because through administrations past, both Republican and Democratic, when the United States has failed to confront China and to defend the international system, the Chinese have become emboldened and have engaged in even more belligerent conduct. Just to take an example, of course, the failure to keep China out of Scarborough Shoal, which is part of the Philippines, that led in very short order to China reclaiming the Spratly features, to pressuring other Philippine reefs, notably Second Thomas Shoal, and also for the Chinese to then go after the Japanese over the Senkakus, what the Chinese call the Daoyus in the East China Sea. So there's no mystery about this at all. We've seen this dynamic a number of times. And just to pick an example from the Obama years is not to say that he was any worse than his predecessor, who was just as bad or maybe even more feeble than Obama. So clearly there's been a path here. The Chinese have understood our psychology and they press the advantage.
Yeah. And it's been to our great detriment. And as you say, it could be a mortal peril cumulatively. Gordon, let me turn to some developments since President Trump met with Xi Jinping that seem to me to be worthy of your clarification. The president there in Osaka, Japan, talked with Xi Jinping about allowing Huawei to continue to obtain various pieces of equipment and technology from American companies. The Commerce Department, we're being told, it does not seem to have gotten the memo. I wonder what you make of where this stands, as well as what should be done with respect to Huawei.
The Commerce Department, in the middle of May, put Huawei, the Chinese telecom equipment manufacturer, on the entity list. And that means with regard to high-tech products that are covered by a specific law or specific regulations, no American company can do business with Huawei. They can't sell products such as semiconductors. They can't license things such as the Android operating system for Huawei smartphones. The Commerce Department apparently has not taken Huawei off the entity list, but the issue is going to be what exemptions are going to be granted. And from President Trump's comments at his press conference after the Osaka G20, it's clear that there are going to be transactions that will be permitted. There's been a lot of comment in the public since then, but it appears that products related to 5G will not be permitted, whereas 4G products will be. This is a mistake, Frank. The Chinese, before the Osaka G20, publicly demanded that President Trump give Huawei a reprieve. Once that occurred, a reprieve should have been out of the question. What President Trump has done is complied with the Chinese demand, and this is going to make it much more difficult in the trade talks. I believe, just as a general matter, that we should have no transactions with Huawei, because you can't divide the company up into a national security threat part and a non-national security threat portion, because money is fungible. That means if we help, for instance, their smartphone business or whatever, that gives them proceeds, which they can use for their servers and routers and their 5G business. So whatever we do with Huawei will undermine American security. President Trump should know that, and we should demand a ban on all transactions with Huawei.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't agree with you more, Gordon, but I must say I do take some heart from this internal letter that a John Sonderman, who's the deputy director of the Office of Export Enforcement, sent to the Commerce Department folks involved in enforcing the entities list. And it makes it sound as though it's going to be the very exceptional case in which this kind of technology sale to Huawei is made. And it shouldn't be done at all. But if it is going to be done, it sounds to me as though the onus is really going to be on the seller rather than on some diktat from the administration to do this. So that's heartening. But let me turn to one other issue, Gordon. There's been some mention that the administration is contemplating giving the Chinese a waiver on the restrictions that it has imposed on the purchase of Iranian oil. What's up with that? Is that, in fact, what you're hearing? And should we be doing such a thing?
Frank, this has been reported. I don't see that there's any justification for this. The Chinese are now evading the oil ban by surreptitious transshipments. This is just basically the administration believing that they can't stop it, so they might as well give waivers. Even if we can't stop it, and we can, Frank, but even if we couldn't stop it, we should not be granting any waivers to China. And this is showing a very disturbing trend. You know, when you put this together with President Trump's capitulation on Huawei, and that's the word it is, what we're doing is we're telling the Chinese that they now determine and run American national security. And if we do anything they don't like, they're just going to issue a veto. This is absolutely wrong. So this is a point where it's an inflection point where the Trump administration has to decide whether it wants good relations with Beijing or whether it wants to defend the American people.
Yeah, this is wrong on two counts, obviously. One is you don't want to be emboldening the Chinese, but you don't want to be enriching the Iranians either. And giving them a pass is certainly even more likely to translate into funds flowing into Tehran than if you oppose it. And they may try to circumvent it, but at least it's not something that you're giving them carte blanche to engage in. Gordon, lastly, let me turn to one thing that you wrote yourself recently about the president's trip to North Korea. Well, just across the line, at least, and to the North Korean part of the demilitarized zone. In the national interest, you suggested that what he has done is upending the relationship in North Asia between the Chinese and the North Koreans, who have long been their proxies and puppets. I'm not sure that we're fully there yet, but is that how you see it? And is that where the president is quite intentionally trying to take it?
The president took, as we all know, 20 steps into North Korea and 20 steps back. And it was not without cost, because we did legitimize Kim Jong-un, but it also was not without benefit. And the benefit that I talk about is that by President Trump strengthening his relationship with Kim Jong-un, I think that what we're doing is we're making it less likely that China will be involved in the denuclearization disarming process. And that's a good thing, because China, over the course of two decades, beginning with the six-party talks in 2003, has been a malign influence with regard to North Korea. So anything that we can do to keep the Chinese out of the process is a win for us. And I think that's what President Trump was trying to do with not only his 20 steps, but with other things that he has been doing recently. You know, I don't like, for instance, a lot of the flowery language regarding Kim Jong-un, but there very well may be a motive behind it to keep the Chinese out. I'm not in President Trump's head, of course, but nonetheless, this seems to be what he's doing. And if indeed that's the case, it's a very good thing.
Yeah, I tend to agree. We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you, Gordon, in your various platforms. We're so appreciative that one of them is ours. Come back to us again next week, if you would. In the meantime, keep up the great work that you do, my friend. God bless you. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Gertz about developments inside the ring with respect to China and much more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for our tour inside the ring. We haven't been there in altogether too long. As our guide and the author of the prize-winning Washington Times column of that name, Bill Gertz, has been elsewhere for the past few weeks. It's always terrific to catch up with him and to pick his brains about a lot of things that are happening, most of which he covers exceptionally well, both at the Washington Times and on his beat as senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon. He is also the author of seven terrific books, including most recently I, War, War and Peace in the Information Age. I'm told there is yet another one in the works to be released shortly, and we can't wait for that. Bill, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Well, again, so much to talk about. I thought I'd just give you a chance to join Gordon Chang and me in expressing concern about this open letter that Susan Thornton and other folks, some of whom have been called panda huggers over the years, have released in the Washington Post last week. What did you make of their call for President Trump to abandon the policy that he has, I think, quite handsomely adopted to, well, begin pushing back against the various threats the Chinese pose to us in favor of their preferred course of, well, it's been called engagement, but appeasement is also a term for it, it seems to me.
That's right. I think that's a more appropriate term. I read the letter. I was very, very surprised that these academics and China experts, quote unquote, were advocating for continued appeasement when we see emerging one of the few bipartisan issues in Washington these days, that is the recognition of the growing threat from China. And I think that these people are trying to protect themselves from the ability to continue to travel to China, and by doing so, basically saying that the Trump administration's hardline policy is wrong. I was very surprised.
Yeah. And needless to say, this is something that has sort of set the stage for a lot of the other things that I want to talk to you about, the sort of practices of appeasement. We've had the Chinese, Bill, as you've reported, testing missiles out of some of these man-made islands that they've created in the South China Sea. This is evidence, it would appear, of bad faith, I'm shocked to say, by Xi Jinping. Tell us a little bit about what is afoot here and why it makes such a mockery of the kind of advice that Ms. Thornton and others are pushing forward at the moment.
Well, the Chinese conducted a flight test of what has been described as an anti-ship ballistic missile. That is a missile that travels into space, re-enters the atmosphere, and has the capability to maneuver with precision targeting to be able to kill an aircraft carrier. And this test was carried out from one of the disputed islands in the Spratly Islands chains. This is the group of islets and reefs that the Chinese have been focusing on, and three reefs in particular where they've built large runways. And so here they tested a anti-ship ballistic missile, and the Pentagon surprisingly confirmed the test last week, and I wrote about that. A spokesman said that this test violated the 2015 pledge that was made by President Xi Jinping to then-President Barack Obama that China would not militarize these islands and reefs in the South China Sea. And as you mentioned, this is extremely significant because right now the Trump administration is pushing to do a trade deal with China, and that raises the question, how can you do a deal with a nation that violates just about every agreement that they've made with you?
Yeah. And that's not just trade agreements, by the way. As you say, Bill, this is a prime example of something very much in the national security sphere as well. Speaking of flight tests, Bill, you observed that they had also recently engaged in a flight test of a new submarine-launched ballistic missile. Ballistic missiles are big in China, it turns out, and they're becoming more ominously so, as these tests indicate. Tell us about the SLBM.
Yeah, this was a test that was taken place from the northern coast of China on a special underwater platform used to test missiles. And it was a missile known as the Jialong 3, JL-3. And this is their newest submarine-launched missile, which will be nuclear-tipped. And it shows that part of an aggressive nuclear modernization program. The missile was flight tested from the Bohai Sea, which is near where their submarine development is, and it flew all the way several thousand miles into the desert in western Xinjiang province. And again, this was very significant because the Chinese missile threat is a major worry for the Pentagon. One of the things that the Pentagon is worried about is that China could, with all of these various types of missiles, and they have probably at least 10 or 15 different types of long-range missiles, they could conduct some type of a surprise strike on U.S. forces around the world. That is a major worry. So the ballistic missile threat from China is something that has to be watched and pushed back against by the U.S. And the need for the U.S. to develop its own missiles highlights this threat.
It does indeed. And I'm afraid that that's without really even taking into account some of the new elements that will make traditional ballistic missiles vastly more formidable, and that is hypersonic devices that can, we're told, defeat our such missile defenses as we have. And Bill, they're seeming to be more and more wanting at the moment as these developments are taking place, a double whammy, if you will, that is exceedingly worrying, as is evidence that Huawei, a company that we were discussing with Gordon Chang a moment ago, has indeed used its purveyance of various kinds of equipment to Western markets to insinuate Trojan horses or trap backdoors or whatever you want to call them, means of gaining access without permission to information coursing through those networks. This is, of course, hugely important at a moment when President Trump has decided he might be amenable to allowing some American technology to continue to support Huawei. Give us the latest on this, Bill, and where you think things stand at the moment.
Yes, a security company called Finite State did a survey of Huawei products and found that a vast majority of them are hardwired or have software that would allow remote access by Chinese intelligence. This was a real wake-up call. It's been known in intelligence circles for many years that Huawei products have this vulnerability, have this ability to allow remote access. But this was the first time that some of the details on these so-called backdoors or trapdoors were made public by this security company. And it certainly highlights the fact that Huawei is anything but a private company. It is basically an arm of the Chinese government, and its main function is to provide access. This will have extreme implications for the emerging 5G network, because Huawei is one of the leaders in developing the super high-speed internet access. And once they do that, then the internet will become even orders of magnitude less secure than it is today. And that's what I think the significant point of this finite state security report.
And presumably this report will feed into efforts by Senator Marco Rubio and others to prohibit the assistance that President Trump is contemplating providing Huawei, and otherwise impede its further penetration, that is Huawei's, of our country's networks and systems. That's something President Trump has not altered his policy on, as I understand it, but it probably is advisable to formalize that in statute as well. Would you expect that to be one of the upshots of this bill, that this finding that 55% of Huawei's hardware devices have at least one backdoor access point exploitable by Chinese intelligence and the military?
Yeah, I'm watching very closely to see if Rubio will be successful in introducing legislation to be able to codify the ban on Huawei products for not just the U.S. government, but for the American public as well. Let's hope that goes forward. He's announced that he wants to do that, and I think that would be a very good thing to do to protect the security of Americans' privacy and electronics.
Yeah, and intellectual property and national security secrets and Internet of Things and on and on and on. Hey, Bill, speaking of Chinese computing antics, talk a little bit about the effort that the United States government is now making to try to counter one other facet of their growing capability in that space, namely curbs on supercomputer technologies transfers. What's up with that?
Well, there is a supercomputer race underway between the U.S. and China, and it has extremely important national security implications because basically the Chinese are developing supercomputer capabilities which will allow them to develop nuclear weapons, again, as part of their aggressive nuclear buildup, and the U.S. Needs to maintain its edge. And this is something that has to be one of the top priorities. I know that this has been milling about in national security circles for at least 5 years now, and hopefully the Trump administration will get on top of it and really push forward the need to hinder the Chinese supercomputer program, which is reliant on a lot of American technology stolen or purchased, and develop U.S. supercomputing capabilities.
Well, this is a subject we'll be following closely, as I know will you. And I appreciate so much your joining us to talk about what you're finding on each of these topics and so much more. Bill Gertz, talk with you again next week.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. This is going to be a difficult segment, I'm afraid, because the story that you're about to hear is a troubling one on a lot of different counts, not least of which is it's another example of what appears to be the wrongful prosecution of men who have served their country in the uniform of the United States military, have done so with distinction, and are now subjected, because of crazy rules of engagement and the enforcement thereof in ways that seem wrong on several different levels. These individuals are serving hard time. In the case of Lieutenant Clint Lawrence, United States Army, 19 years of hard time is what he is currently sentenced to perform. Six of those have already been served in the military brig in Leavenworth, Kansas. His attorney for a defense team that is now trying to have Lieutenant Lawrence's case essentially overturned by the President of the United States is with us. I've just had a brief chance to talk with him. His name is Lieutenant Colonel John Mayer, United States Army Reserves. He is leading the fight to try to, as I say, get justice for Lieutenant Lawrence, and I'm very pleased to have him here to talk to us a little bit about, well, the miscarriage of justice that seems to have been perpetrated here and what can be done about it. Thank you, Colonel. It's good to have you with us, sir, and thank you for what you're doing on behalf of this officer. Tell us a little bit about what prompted the prosecution of Lieutenant Lawrence in the first place.
What prompted the prosecution of Lieutenant Lawrence was the Army's rules of engagement and the Army's concern about civilian casualties on the battlefield. 2 weeks prior to Lieutenant Lawrence's engagement on July 2, 2012, in the Zaire district of Kandahar province, the height of the fighting season in the ancestral home of the Taliban, he was leading a combat infantry patrol of 82nd Airborne Paratroopers. He had only been with the unit for 4 days, and the reason he was new to the unit was the previous platoon leader had been blown up on the very same patrol route by an improvised explosive device, otherwise known as a bomb that was put in the ground. By virtue of that, when Lawrence, one of his paratroopers, called out a threat that he perceived three teenage males on a single motorcycle gunning towards their platoon's exposed route of march through a minefield, the soldier called out that threat, and Lawrence ordered him to fire. The soldier fired but missed, but Lawrence then got on the radio and he ordered an overwatch gun truck that he had placed in a position for this very type of anticipated threat to fire. Two of the riders were killed and one escaped unharmed. Later that day, the entire unit was brought off the line and all of them were accused of murder. At least nine, to be more specific, were accused of murder and separated from Lawrence because the United States believed that those riders were not sufficiently threatening and they were civilians. One of the paratroopers, as they were conducting their exfiltration back to post after their patrol, said, "Hey, I believe that to be a village elder." So by virtue of that, a civilian casualty report went up and then murder charges came down. All of the idea that 2 weeks prior to this patrol, another Afghan man and his child shot killed by an American soldier and President Hamid Karzai was there in the Zaire district and in the Panjwani district 2 weeks prior to bring, understandably, attention to the matter that he wanted, of course, the Americans not to be killing civilians. So that's what happened in this case. But the legal problem is the travesty of justice, as my fellow co-counsel and author Don Brown has written in his book that's available right now called Travesty of Justice, that the prosecution urged the jury that at all times these were innocent villagers. These were innocent civilians. But in a database search away, these men left their fingerprints and DNA, meaning their skin, when they twist fires to make bombs, on improvised explosive devices at grid coordinates where American paratroopers had been blown up or killed. Now, the Army believes that that is irrelevant information because Lawrence didn't know that at the time he gave the order to fire. But the initial soldier who called out the threat, he testified that he complied with the rules of engagement and perceived them as a deadly threat, that they were going to either come by and blow themselves up as a V-bed, a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device. They would conduct a, quote, drive-by. They would conduct a grenade toss. So he fired his rifle consistent with the rules of engagement. So if there's evidence of rules of engagement that you use deadly force, now add in that the deadly force actually killed the enemy and there can be no murder. That's why this evidence is important.
This evidence and what's gone on here is so worrying, though, because it seems to suggest, again, that the chain of command and the military justice system in this case and others like it is really rigged against the individuals on the ground making life and death decisions under the most difficult of circumstances.
I think you brought an incredible issue to bear right there. And that is, we have direct evidence in the Lawrence case from the battalion command sergeant major, the senior most enlisted advisor at the battalion level, that the entire chain of command created a narrative to distance themselves from Lawrence that morning because none of them wanted to have a negative impact on their own career trajectories or promotions by being associated with a civilian casualty. That's why they made Lawrence up to be a bad apple, a rogue officer, wanted to fight the war on his own terms, hated people, hated Afghans, and wanted to murder and manufacture combat rather than do his duty as a platoon leader, which is to accomplish the mission and bring your paratroopers home safely.
Yeah, there is reason to believe that in the course of the proceedings against him, there were a number of steps taken by the prosecution that also raised questions about the charges against him and or the way in which the evidence was provided to the defense counsel, the defense counsel's performance itself before you all joined the team. This is the sort of thing that it does seem warrants an effort to encourage President Trump to disapprove the findings and the sentence that has been meted out to Lieutenant Clint Lawrence. Tell us where this stands at the moment and how people in our listening audience, for example, could help ensure that this soldier gets the justice he is due and that this seemingly quite egregious miscarriage of justice is overturned.
Well, I'm very happy to report that we're proceeding on two similar paths at the same time. Number one, like you mentioned, we are asking the president, and we've got papers filed with the Secretary of the Army, the Office of the Pardon Attorney with the Justice Department, and the White House, where we're asking the president to exercise his constitutional authority, but also his statutory authority under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, Article 22, which makes him a convening authority. And what that means is he can disapprove the findings in the sentence in Lawrence's case, which is different than a pardon. And the reason that's important is if the convening authority, in this case the president, disapproves the findings in the sentence, it restores Lieutenant Lawrence to status quo ante, as if this thing never happened. At the same time, we have a federal lawsuit pending in civilian court in federal court in Kansas under the habeas corpus statute, in which we're bringing to bear all of the prosecutor's missteps and violations of the Fifth Amendment due process clause by withholding evidence that these quote-unquote civilians, were truly bomb makers, and therefore the jury should have known that. There was a significant activity report that the Army generated, which says that Lawrence's platoon was being threatened for impending attacker, and that was not disclosed. And the aerostat operator, which is the Goodyear blimp eye in the sky, which provides optics for ground force commanders who can't see over burns and can't see through a village, to say, hey, you're being scouted or attacked. On July 2, 2012, the aerostat operator took video of three fighting age males dismounted, scouting and probing Lawrence's platoon so much so that he made a report to the Tactical Operations Center saying, you better tell that lieutenant he's walking into an ambush. That report was never disclosed, and that video was never disclosed. Moreover, the aerostat operator reached out to defense counsel at the time and say, listen, I have some information that could be helpful to your client. And defense counsel at the time did not return the email.
This is really outrageous. Come back to us further, if you would, because I'd like to get into this more and understand with you whether, as increasingly seems, this is part of a pattern of these sorts of travesties and something that really needs to be corrected, hopefully by President Trump, right quick. Thank you for joining us, sir. Come back to us soon. Thanks to all of you for joining us. I hope you'll do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.